G'day and welcome to episode 11 of the Baffled 80s podcast. I'm your host, Tom O'Halloran. Today's episode is with Duncan Brown. Duncan has been a coach running Athlete by Choice for several years now, and has, in the last few years, moved into becoming the National Coaching Director for Sport Climbing Australia, the competition side of climbing in Australia. With the Australian National Championships coming up in just over a week's time, I thought this would be a good opportunity to get this chat out. It's an exciting time in the competition side of climbing in the world, really, with the Olympics coming up in Tokyo 2020. Duncan gets into the nitty-gritty details of how the qualification process works, but essentially, if you place well at Nationals next week, it means that we get into the Oceania Championships next March. The winner from there will take the Olympic spot for the Oceania region. So apart from the Olympic side of things, we also get into the inner workings of Sport Climbing Australia and the struggles that essentially the volunteer organisation has in looking after the governing body of our sport, which is now, as I've already said, an Olympic sport. It's kind of crazy the amount of work these people do. In the chat, Duncan gets into some of the issues that Sport Climbing Australia have. One of the major hurdles that Sport Climbing Australia has at the moment is a lack of funding. One of the big things that would really help at the moment, and Duncan talks about this, is if there's anyone out there that has proposal writing or grant writing experience that would love to help the sport out and donate their time to helping attract some funding for our athletes and our governing body, that would be a huge help. We start our talk with Duncan explaining what the Olympics looks like for both climbing internationally and in Australia.
It is really exciting. There were plenty of people, I think, that were unsure when we first, as a sport, got brought into the Olympics. But I think now it's changed to a point where everyone's just interested. And as far as Australians are concerned, you're right. Like, we're a really sport-proud sort of nation.
We love our sport.
We love our sport, right?
Yeah.
And for us as climbers, like, we're the same. We love our sport. And I think it doesn't really matter what sort of view you had in the first place about climbing becoming an Olympic sport. No one can sort of help but be interested. Like, everyone's, as it's developed and we get closer, it's less than 18 months ago away. It's close. It's around the corner. And I think even the most dyed-in-the-wool, you know, adventure trad climber is probably still looking there being like, this is going to be fun. This is going to be interesting. Like, everyone wants to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, I was one of those skeptical people, I have to admit, from the beginning. It was just like, man, like, us having to combine the lead, the boulder, and the speed into one medal just is junk. Like, you know, we're bending over, but then there was
good reason. Well, I'd say to clarify, like, the reason why we've ended, and a lot of people, like, aren't aware of, like, really why this ended up happening. To clarify it, the IOC gave climbing one medal, and then IFSC had to decide what the event was going to be.
So what do they do? Do they say, sorry, boulderers, you're not going to be part of
Bingo.
The Olympics?
So that's why they were like, all right, if we say all three combined, because they started doing the combined medals in 2012 at the World Championships. Mm. They didn't have a combined final, but there was a combined medal. Mm. So it was already a thing. And they were like, if we use that, we get all three disciplines in the door. Mm. And if we manage to stay in the door, because we're not guaranteed, we've been confirmed for Paris now, but it's not a guaranteed, we're not a legacy sport. So we can just not be in an Olympics all of a sudden. But once we get a foot in the door, it's easier to ask for another medal than it is to ask for another sport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was like, it wasn't the best thing in a lot of people's minds, but it got us in the door. And now Paris, it's to be confirmed by the IOC, but Paris has pretty much been confirmed to have two medals, and we're going to be having lead and boulder combined with speed separate. So the ultimate goal is to have us there with four sets of medals. So we'll have lead, we'll have Boulder, we'll have speed, we'll have a combined, same as there is in the World Championships.
Yeah.
That's the ideal that we've got to head towards. But beggars can't be choosers, right?
Mm.
We would have been sitting here saying, all right, lead climbing is an Olympic sport, but bouldering and speed aren't, or whatever.
Or like speed isn't, who gets
to choose that? And I think it was the wise choice, because now we see in Paris, we've got two medals.
Yeah.
So,
and it's also pretty interesting, I have to say, watching all the athletes online, on Instagram, training for all three disciplines.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's lots of skin being lost at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, you can't, one of the parts of my training is trying to climb faster at different points. And in my bouldering training, some of the stuff I have to do is do problems 10% faster. So, you know, it's going to be interesting, I think, overall to see what it does to climbers and to climbing.
Absolutely. I think it's definitely, even though we're going to, after this Olympics, not have to worry about this three discipline combined, I think it's opened a lot of people's eyes to the professional aspects of training and team management and lots of other facets that we wouldn't have had to deal with in quite the same way if we didn't have to deal with the combined. And I think it's taught a lot of athletes a lot of really interesting things. You look at the amount of explosive power required to be a fast speed climber and try and tell me that's not relevant to boulders or high-end sport climbers. It's...
Yeah, you see some of the stuff
this crossover.
Like the Reza, the Iranian dude, is doing. And it's like he's just doing outrageous like double hand dyno kind of stuff on the campus board and all that. And it's like, man, that is like what some boulderers dream of having, is that power. And to bring that into, yeah, your bouldering game, your sport climbing game, or, you know, the lead climbers being forced to, you know, really get into pursuing a bit of bouldering and upping their power levels.
And to have to climb faster and not get timed out.
Yeah.
Yeah. That as well.
Yeah. So how do you see that on the ground in Australia, in the climbing gyms? Like, your role as the head coach of the Australian climbing team, where does that look for us as a nation in developing climbers for the Olympics?
Yeah, there's probably a few layers to that, really.
Yeah.
So to give everyone a bit of a perspective on the structure and the team that we've got in place here in Australia, Sport Climbing Australia has a coaching team. I'm the coaching director. Then we have three discipline coaches. We have a lead coach, a speed coach, and a boulder coach. We have an assistant coach, and we have a physiotherapist. So that's our entire team. From there, most of the states have a state coach. And from there, it's commercial coaches, really. So we're seeing a few changes, I think, around Australia. There's a bit of a growth in that coaching industry. There's a little bit of an uptake of people engaging with sports professionals. And as far as our team is concerned, we're trying to obviously manage as much athlete development as we can on a pretty limited budget. So we're trying to provide training camps and athlete development activities that are going to be useful for those athletes to help them learn how to be athletes, how to undertake training in a more effective way, what sort of professionals they need to engage with, you know, whether that's coaches, whether that's physical trainers, whether that's dietitians, whether that's sports psychologists, trying to educate them better as to what their needs really are and how they can then engage with the right professionals. And it's complex.
And so that's for the junior team and the open team. So we've got an open Australian team and a junior Australian team.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so roughly how many athletes?
There's 60 something currently. I have to look at my list. That was probably something I should have looked up first. So you've got the open team, and there's the lead team, the boulder team, the speed team.
Mm-hmm.
We have the youth team, and there's lead, speed, and boulder there as well. There's also a youth development team.
Mm-hmm.
And the international youth team are the ones that are able to, from youth B upwards, that can go to the World Youth Championships. Mm-hmm. And then we have a development team who are the next places behind them that we can help to grow as young athletes. So there's quite a lot of people in a lot of different places with a small team.
It's interesting because, you know, I think when you're not on the ground in Sydney or in any of the states, mm-hmm. in the actual city centre working with the teams or getting to train with the teams,
yep.
You're not exposed to what's available. And so I guess for people listening at home, it was interesting for us to phone you and have a chat with you about what the process is of getting picked for the Australian team, mm-hmm. and what resources can potentially be available and what the focus is for the athletes that do get chosen going into the Olympics. And yeah, it was exciting and motivating actually to talk to you about that, instead of sort of feeling like, you know, you're out there on your own trying to work out how the hell to make it.
Where do we find this information?
Well, we could actually talk to the Australian coach or one of the coaches and find out. Yeah.
Yeah. And the tricky thing is that all of that information is out there for the general public. Like, you can all go to the Sport Climbing Australia website and you can go into all the documents there where all of the official documentation is. It's all available to the public and everyone can read all of those charters. They can read all of the rules. They can read all of the selection policies. Everything,
because they're a bit like IKEA instructions, though, aren't they? And nobody ever does.
Yeah, no one ever reads the instructions. That's right. It's like, I don't know what this is about, but then the information is there. But it can also be hard to translate into real terms too. Mm. It's tricky sometimes to be reading all these documents, being like, where do I fit into this process? Like, what do I actually have to do?
Mm.
And when you do, like, we had that conversation, and we can. It's easy when you have that conversation and just say you have to do X, then you can do Y, then you can do Z. That's your step-by-step process.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, my first climbing comp would have been in 2004, like a little social series kind of one in Queensland. Mm-hmm. And I remember my dad was a part of the Queensland kind of comp. Like SCA, or it was maybe something
sport
different.
Climbing in Queensland.
Yeah. But he was a part of that. And I remember him being up way late at night doing all sorts of volunteer work to try and get those comps up and running and, you know, talking to the right people and doing sponsorship kind of proposals for, you know, Mountain Designs or whoever it was at the time to try and get behind all of this. And, you know, that volunteer stuff is still there as a part of it. And, you know, we're coming into an Olympic cycle. Like, you know, there's people that are now properly, Olympics is on their mind. It's 18 months away or so.
We have people training right now under the assumption that they are going to be trying to qualify for the Olympics.
Like, yeah.
That's what's happening right
now. And we have two spots.
And we've still got, you know, a really big drive of volunteers behind that, making that happen.
Yeah. And it's entirely volunteer driven.
Yeah. It'll be cool to see perhaps that evolve into something a bit more formal in the future and you know, those positions being.
Yeah. Having people in paid roles.
Yeah. It would be pretty awesome. But, you know, so for the progression into August 2020.
Yeah.
Is climbing's first showing at a broad public kind of thing. Where are we kind of headed for that? You know, for Oceania, the region that Australia sits in, that's Australia, New Zealand and New Caledonia. Is that right?
And Fiji and a few other places.
Yeah. And there's one spot for a male and one spot for a female available for a climber from that region to represent
their
country at the Olympics.
Yep.
Like how do you get that spot?
How do you get the spot? All right. So let's lay it all out. So there's three different ways through which someone can qualify for the Olympics next year. One of the ways is at the World Championships in Japan this year. The top seven combined athletes from the World Championships 2019 get spots in the Olympics next year. Then there is the combined ranking from all of the World Cup series this year, And at the end of that, there will be a special event for the top 20 ranked athletes from all the World Cups. So they have to compete in, I guess, at least one of each discipline to get a ranking.
How many World Cup events count? Because there's some athletes that miss World Cups.
You end up with this, you end up with a ranking based on your best performances.
Okay.
And the going to more is better.
Right.
It's still going to be better for you to go to more. So big teams like the Japanese are strategizing this stuff. Mm. There's a special event in Toulouse, end of November, that's for those top 20 combined athletes, and the top six from that get a spot at the Olympics. Then there's the five continental championships, Africa, Europe, Asia, Oceania, and the Americas. And each of those, the top person from each of those continental championships gets a spot. So that's 7 and 6 and 5. So that's 18 spots. Then there's one extra spot for the host nation. So Japan gets one extra spot. And there's one that's given out by the Tripartite Commission. So they will likely give that to an athlete that is, I mean, we don't know for sure who they're going to give it to, but they'll give it to someone probably from an underrepresented region that still has an athlete that is on par.
Yep.
Yeah.
And for us here in Australia, the most likely path is going to be that top spot at the Continental Championships.
Yeah.
And that will be here in Australia in April, I believe.
Next year.
Next year. And that's the top place. In the combined. It will only be a combined event. And it'll be the top place at that event gets the spot. And that could be a Kiwi, could be an Australian, could be a Fijian.
Mm.
It's not going to be a New Caledonian, because New Caledonia, even though they compete with us in this region, they're a French colony. So their athletes are French, not Oceanic.
Yep.
So that's probably a little bit lucky for us, because that means we don't have like the French athletes coming over
Fanny
and
Gilbert.
Like
we don't need to compete against
like the Maywin brothers or something.
So
we've got a good chance. Like, I think we've got a bit of a golden ticket. There's some great athletes out of New Zealand, but I think currently in a combined format, I don't think we're likely to not see Australians go to the Olympics. So we're very fortunate.
Just quickly, we'll explain that combined format. And that's what we're going to see at the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mix of a boulder problem sort of circuit, a lead climb, and some speed. And so do you want to just explain kind of how that works?
Because you get points for each.
Yes, you do. So a good thing for everyone listening to go and do is to go and watch the combined final from the 2018 World Championships in Innsbruck, because it was done fantastically as far as like the viewership, like the production value was, is concerned. So it's really good viewing. And you see they had the top six athletes from the combined. So the six athletes that ranked the highest with their combined scores from the separate events.
Yeah, because there was a separate speed event to become the lead.
That's correct.
World champ, lead world champ, boulder world champ.
Correct.
And then the combined ranking after that goes into the combined final.
That's correct. And the top six went into that final, and it was the first time they'd really like given that format, that combined format final, a test run.
Mm. You could tell by the bleeding tips.
But the bleeding tips are like partially also those people have competed for the last 8 days.
Yeah.
To get that spot in that combined final. Yeah. We won't see that at the Olympics, because they just do a combined qualification round and a combined final. They do the qualification, they get a rest day, they do the final.
Yeah.
And that's the way it'll lay out at the Olympics. So what they do is they come out and they all do a set of speed races. So you have the shooting match, because it's racing against each other. So it's like you and I, Tom, we race. I lose next round. Like, you know, Amanda's won her round and it's you guys. Obviously, it's split by gender.
If I was a guy.
You were a guy. So that you do your shooting match and you end up with like the ranking through that, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. They're going to do eight in the final for the Olympics. Hmm. Then straight away you take your harness off and you go round the back of the bouldering wall and you come out and you do a boulder final. 4 minute round, 4 minutes max each.
Just like a World Cup boulder.
Just like a World Cup final.
Yeah.
For the combined format, they've changed it. It's going to be three boulders, not four.
Yeah.
They did four in Innsbruck. It was a bit much. They decided to take it to three. Straight after everyone finishes that, you all put your harnesses back on and you do a lead on site final. Yeah. Like it's one lead route. So there's just that one speed shooting match. You got one round of boulders, one lead route.
And are they back all evenly weighted? So if you win speed, for example, does the person one get, say, 20 points, person two gets 15?
So your ranking is your number, so first, second, third, one, two, three.
Yep.
And you times your place together. So if you came first, you've got one times one, it's one.
And the person
if you went
the
second,
lowest
second, second,
points.
The lowest points is
yeah.
So if you went second, 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 it'd be two times two times two, which is eight.
If you've got one and six, then
it'd be six. Yeah. So it weights them all evenly.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the interesting thing for me. Like in the beginning, when I heard about the Olympics being all of it, you're like, man, that sucks. I don't want to have to do that. But then there's something kind of cool about the idea of having to become such a well-rounded climber. Like you've got to do everything so well because each of them counts equally for the whole thing. And it's like, that's kind of cool. Like for me, I've always wanted to be able to be as good as I possibly can be at every different style. And it's like, well, here's the opportunity to show what you've got in that indoor climbing competitive realm. It's like,
can I be as good as I think I can be? Like, can I do this? It's a challenge.
That leads me into a bit of a question then that Tom and I have talked about quite a lot because, you know, I went in the Chamonix World Lead Cup in, I think it was 2005. And, you know, back then there was no support for athletes.
No.
You know, make your own shirts and all that sort of thing. And also we were trying to compete on a world stage using Penrith Climbing Gym with, I think, a climbing wall that was 8 metres high. And that was the facilities we had available to us.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, I've always sort of looked at these new boulder gyms popping up and having like full-time route-setting jobs and it's changing the face of bouldering.
Absolutely.
But you know, for someone like Tom O'Halloran here, you know, for him to be able to be competitive in a World Cup climbing event, what does he do about having grade 28 plastic roots to be able to train on? And so what do you see, I guess, as where we need to take Australian climbing and Australian climbing gyms and facilities to be able to get what we need for Australian climbers to be competitive? And I think Tom's probably got a question to add in there as well around that.
Sure. It's a tricky one because commercial facilities, as we all know, they're a commercial facility. They need to earn money. And the style of setting and the level of setting here in Australia needs to be accessible because the market is, especially for these modern bouldering gyms, it's this fitness activity. Mm. It's not necessarily people that were already climbers going to these gyms. They do go to those gyms, but the reason those gyms are all full of climbers now is because those were people who didn't climb before and they came in and they enjoyed the activity and they got drawn into...
They weren't going to the bouldering gym to train for roots.
No, they go there because it's a fun fitness activity. Mm. And the style of the problems can be very similar these days to modern competitive bouldering, but the level's not going to be there. It's very rare to walk into a gym in Australia that someone that's on our national team can't just pretty much flash everything in the gym.
Well, yeah, that's Tom's experience.
Yeah.
On the whole. I mean, you know, it's different. You go to somewhere like Nomad and they've got like the comp wall and they've got some
There'll be a
cool
few really
setting.
Good
There'll
things
few,
for sure.
But usually he can tick most of the gym.
Yeah, you'll get the gym done in a day or something. And you'll be like, well, you know, I need more difficult things. So you got to seek those things out. And in a lead sense, it's even more so the case that there's not the right things for you. And there's two problems with that. One is that no commercial gym in Australia needs to be full of like 32s and 33s because like there's a handful of people that could even get on them in general in those gyms. And secondly, we set commercially very differently to the way that competition routes are set. Commercial routes tend to, and Australian competitive routes for a long time until recently, tend to lead you into them. It's like, it's not too hard. It lets you get up the wall a bit and then it starts getting difficult. Whereas that's not how it works on a competitive stage. Mm. It's difficult from the get-go. It's hard straight off the ground. And then there'll be a bit of a midsection and then it's going to be this compounding effect.
I think that's actually, that's the shock I got when, you know, I walked out, fourth athlete out into like the echoing quietness of Chamonix because there's not a crowd there yet because I'm not Maya Vidmer and Angela Aita. And, you know, you've got your one Aussie that's traveling with you sitting in there going, come on, and it's echoing. And you're like, you pull on to the first three moves and you're just shocked at how hard the
You're like,
the first
why does this start with a V5? What's going on?
Yeah, why is this so hard? Every other climb I've done has had like 14 jugs first and then you've got your crux and
exactly.
You know, somewhere to rest. So
yeah, and that's that commercial setting in Australia and even our comp setting because the competitions are very different over here. The fields are very different. So you didn't want to just like have, you know, 13 people falling off the second move and then two people getting up the route. Mm. It had to be different. But that leaves us with a problem as far as training and working with athletes is concerned because we rely, at this point, we rely on commercial facilities for all of our national team training events and all that sort of stuff. So when you said, like, what's the solution? Like, how do we... The solution is for us to find enough money to build a national training facility. Mm. That's something that we sort of talk a lot about in Sport Climbing Australia about where we can possibly find funding, the different avenues through which you can source revenue. And it's no small fry. I mean, to build a decent quality national training facility, I mean, someone has to throw us $5 million or something. It's not a small amount of money. Mm. So it's tricky. It's very tricky.
Yeah, it's, you see like the facility in Innsbruck, their new gym, it's kind of like just,
if I could have a quarter of that.
Oh, it's the pinnacle of what like indoor climbing is these days. Like it's so far beyond. I think someone was telling me they spent a couple of million pounds, euros probably, just on holds.
Yeah.
Like a couple of million euros. It's like just that is outrageous. Like and there's full-time route setters that are World Cup level certified route setters setting in there. And
yep.
Like, you know, they've got 9A plus, 36 set in the gym.
Yeah.
And in my mind, like I remember being in at the old Urban Climb in Brisbane, in West End there, it's where I started. And my understanding of difficulty in climbing was yellow, then blue, purple, green, red, black.
Yeah.
And within that, there was yellow one, yellow two, yellow three, and all the way up to the black threes. And I remember thinking, like just getting through and I was like, man, I'm up to reds now. This is awesome. Like I'm so good. I'm at reds. And then I was like, I remember doing some of my first blacks and it was like, this is like, I'm crushing. As good as people have ever been because that was my perception of what was there. And in reality, like a black two was probably like a 23 or something, or a 24. Yep. And so there almost needs to be, I think now, for us to become competitive in this in the international world as a country, we need to raise what we see as being difficult. Like we can't see V8 as difficult because that is... It should be jugs. Like those boulders that we see in the World Cups, like we need to be at that level. And you hear of, you know, V14s being set in Japan and
about like, 20 people in the gym being able to do them.
Yeah, or at least on it and attempting and like giving it some solid cracks. Like we need to change our mindset, I think, as to what the level is.
I think also, and you know, you can sort of, you can fight from the ropes or you can step out of the crowd. And I think, like, for me, having been part of climbing for so long and having competed for so long, I love competing. I think it's super fun. And still, you know, compete now, even though I'm older.
Spring chicken, what are you talking about?
Well, I feel like a spring chicken. But I think it's time for, like, the gyms to go to have a bit more faith in the public and their members and see who they'd attract. Because I think also they don't know who they're missing. Because there's no draw. There is a massive climbing community in the Blue Mountains. It has just, it's probably times by five since I moved here. It's massive now. And it's rare that we would go and route climb in the city because, like, we'd go on Boulder because the routes aren't hard enough for us to try. So I wonder what would happen if they just took a chance and went, okay, look, we're going to have 232s, 231s, 230s, 229s, put it on Instagram, advertise it for people. And, you know, it could just be a draw card as well.
Yeah. I think it's obviously scary for a commercial facility to sacrifice space when space and holds are limited. There are only a couple of gyms realistically in the country that can have long, you know, competition standard routes. There's not that many. That's why, like, there's only a few facilities that we can have lead comps in.
So what facilities, I guess that's interesting, what facilities are there?
So you've got Sydney Indoor Climbing Gym.
Yeah.
You have Hard Rock down in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And there's a couple other gyms around the country that have, like, good quality lead walls, but
like
no one has,
for example.
Yeah. But, like, so Villawood and Hard Rock would be the two that we'd have sort of almost have to have lead national level competitions at, simply because they're the only ones with the height.
Yeah, okay.
There's other walls that are, like, you know, like West End up in Brisbane. There's fantastic walls and fantastic gyms, but very few have the height. So it's really hard to have, like, a high-end competition that's of an international standard.
And it's relevant.
That's, yeah, that's relevant on, like, an 8-meter high wall.
It needs to be, correct me if I'm wrong, it needs to be vertical height of, like, 15 meters or something like that to be internationally recognized as, like, a legit competition.
Yep, absolutely.
And do we actually have a speed wall in Australia?
We have two. So we have the one that's in Villawood in Sydney.
Is that the right height and that's the right set?
It's, from what I understand, it is as close to spec as we can hope for.
Yeah.
It's almost, Carly put a bunch of time in recently to just making some adjustments where it wasn't quite right.
Yeah.
And she's done a great job of getting that as close to spec as it's going to be.
Yeah.
The wall is the correct angle, I believe, and it's the correct height,
yeah,
all that stuff. There's a wall in Gravity Works in Melbourne that's almost exactly to spec as well. I believe there's a small difference between the height of the floor and the first bolt or something. There's some sort of discrepancy at the very, very bottom, I believe, but it's as close to spec as we can need. Yeah. So, and that's it. We have two speed walls.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're in commercial facilities that, again, we rely on for training camps and all that sort of stuff. So, again, it comes back to us having a facility that we could have all these things we need, having a up-to-standard speed wall, having a competition-standard lead wall, having competition-standard bouldering walls, and having the ability for us to have setters set to a standard that's relevant for those athletes, to expose those athletes to the difficulties they're going to be presented with it when they go abroad.
Yeah.
That would be incredible to have something like that. It's like, this is a no compromise facility. Like, this doesn't need to necessarily turn a profit each day. Like, this is for,
it's a sporting training facility.
Like, and like, the gyms in Australia do an incredible job. Like, absolutely awesome. They've developed some really just awesome communities and climbers, and given a really positive, like, awesome kind of way of life for so many different people, whether that's that they become climbers or whether that's just their way of blowing off a bit of steam on a Tuesday and Thursday night. Like, they're awesome.
The gyms are doing a much greater job, they've all always done a good job in Australia of creating community around them. And those communities are growing and growing and growing with a very diverse, like I said, a diverse range of people with a diverse range of reasons for being there.
Yeah,
absolutely. And we've had to rely on those gyms and their generosity to run competitive climbing in this country.
Oh, I've talked a lot to Carly. Like whenever there's a comp on, I send her, because Carly and I've competed together for so many years. And, you know, now our kids, you know, we've sort of almost had babies together and our kids are a similar age. So we face similar juggles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Happy times and stressful training times when you're trying to red point while your child is being busy at the base. But, you know, I send her messages of support when comps are on because I know how much Robbie put into them. And I know there's lots of other people around Australia that do, but she's the person that I've spoken to firsthand about that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of people that are responsible, that are trying really hard, and they're responsible for us having a scene at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't have national training facilities and comp facilities and all the rest, every competition, with only a handful of exceptions in the history of climbing in Australia, have been run in a commercial facility. And every single time they do that, they have to take a loss because comps aren't profitable.
No.
And closing your business is definitely not profitable. And you've got to close it for multiple days to be able to do all the route setting, get it all set up, and then run this event, and then reset your gym back to commercial standard.
Mm.
Like, there's so much work that goes into it. And there's the route setters and the officials and the organizers and the coaches and everyone. And everyone's a volunteer. Everyone's working so hard to get this all to happen, and people are sacrificing their time and their money to make all this happen. So I think it's hard to bring it back to the standards thing. It's hard to then also expect gyms to be like, and now we'll donate a bunch of our space in our gym to having this stuff that might or might not work commercially. It's a hard thing to ask when we're already asking so much of them.
So your vision, I guess, the vision for Australian climbing is to have a national climbing facility that is not a commercial facility.
100%.
Sort of like the Institute of Sport or the institutes around. I mean, I've been to NSWIS, New South Wales Institute of Sport, quite a lot. I've been to the Institute of Sport in Canberra for courses and things.
And that's exactly what in pie in the sky, that's what I'd like.
No, let's make it happen. We need to make it happen.
That's what I want. Absolutely. And that's what we need to be able to progress forwards. And
absolutely.
It's a tricky one because it does involve a lot of money and a lot of, a lot of work on a lot of people's behalves to make something like that happen. But we're going to struggle to continue to develop the sport to an international level when we don't have the facilities in which to do so. At the moment, if we had money, which is another thing we just don't have, in order for us to help our potential Olympians become the best they can be, I would just take that money and put everyone on a plane and we'd all just go live in Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what Tom and I have talked about.
It's the only way.
Yeah.
We don't have the facilities here
to
be able to really help those athletes. And we see how many of our athletes do it at the moment, where they go and they train abroad and they spend time in Europe, they spend time in Japan. They do all this stuff because they can't prepare properly at home. And it's not for lack of trying, and it's not for lack of people putting the effort in. It's just we're not at a stage yet where we have all of the ingredients in place.
Well, to speak for Tom just for a moment, it's, when we've had some serious conversations about whether or not he would go for the Olympics, and he's decided he'll try and get a place on the team. You know, as someone who's climbed, pushing the level of outdoor climbing, winning bouldering nationals, coming second or being right up there in lead nationals. But for us, it's, and for, people, I guess, juniors listening at home, the things you think about are, okay, how do we pay the mortgage and pay for life while Tom's overseas training? How do we pay to get him overseas to train? Because it's not very fun. You know, my experience of that World Cup, which will lead into asking you a bit about what your role is in the World Cups, was showing up in Chamonix, camping on the side of the road, free camping, being able to afford one night of accommodation, which we did, I think, either the night before the comp. So we slept in a bed before the comp. Showing up to the comp having not slept very well and going into isolation with these rock stars of the climbing world and being quite intimidated, to be honest, to even get on to warm up on the tiny warm-up wall that you've got. And then, you know, walking out and not really, you've got someone with a big bucket with a rope in it and you're like, where do I even go?
Like, I don't know what's going on.
And then afterwards, where do I go now? Do I go back to the school gym or do I just go and get a Nutella crepe? You know, it's so it's, you know, there's quite a big process involved with living this far away from where all the comps happen and making it happen so that you can actually be competitive and what it costs you in the rest of your life to be able to do that. So, yeah, it, I think it's an interesting one to work out how we can support people to do that.
Yeah. And it unfortunately always comes down to money.
I know. Isn't it a bummer? Anyone got a lotto win?
Yeah. Anyone with a winning lotto ticket, just drop us a line. Now, it's tricky because it really does just come down to dollars in the bank. And we have motivated people working voluntarily to try and help the sport here in the country. We have lots of really intelligent people with fantastic things to bring to the table. We just don't have the financial resources to do something with that we'd like. Well, we don't have the resources to do everything we'd like to do with that.
Yeah.
To help the athletes. Because, like you said, there's that experience is one of the most valuable things that an athlete can have. Like, once you're already at a level where you're able to perform, you still can go to a World Cup and just be like, flabbergasted and then perform terribly because you don't have that competition experience. So you're going to be up against, like, potentially we're going to have athletes that are going to get to the Olympics that have, you know, a tenth of the competition experience that their competition.
Even a hundredth.
Because there's people out there doing like, entire World Cup seasons and World Championships and all their like domestic competition circuit, which is like way bigger than anything we've got. And they've been doing it since they were kids as well. Mm. All these superstars that you see on a world stage now came up through the youth ranks competing in like youth world championships. And people tend to forget, they see these young superstars, they're allowed to compete in World Cups from the age of 16, youth A, year one. And people would be like, this kid's come out of nowhere and has just like crushed all this stuff. And you're like, no, they've been competing at massive events, European Youth Cups, all this stuff for the last like 8 years. Mm. They've domestically competed in events that are bigger than anything that most people in Australia can imagine. And that's how they grew up. So this isn't their first rodeo. They're not turning up at a World Cup and just at winning their first comp at 16. No, they are veterans at that age. And we have our athletes, we're on the wrong side of the world. We have to spend a fortune to travel. You can't afford to just go and just do a World Cup season.
Yeah, we're looking at July for Tom and you're thinking, okay, 3 weeks, what are flights? How much accommodation is that? How long is it away for? And that's just to try and get 3 World Cups in.
Yeah. Mm. And it's a challenge financially. And it's something that can only be rectified with money in the bank.
Yeah, so I guess that, go, Tom.
That was I chatted with Robbie LeBreton about his role. Kind of, I guess he came in post the 2008 Sydney World Youth Championships, which was held at the St. Peter's Climbing Gym, which from my point of view as a climber in that was an awesome comp. But I know it was, again, like it was just massively driven by the volunteers and it burnt them dry. And SCA kind of looked like falling over a little bit, and Robbie and Carly came in and tried to kind of pick up the pieces, and they were kind of just left with this bit of a carcass, really. Not because the other people weren't doing a great job, but they put everything into this event, and it was a really good thing and it was awesome, but it's just huge. And Robbie was saying kind of basically, the financial side of things is just the biggest hurdle for us to overcome in terms of getting athletes to the events, to get athletes to a level to be competitive at events, to get support networks to the events in terms of having people there like yourself as the head coach and Justine as the physio and Will and Kim and everyone else that's involved, like to have the right people there as a support network for the athlete, like it's massive to make that happen and to make it a reality for someone to be competitive with what we see as the superstars.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of sacrifice from a lot of people for us to end up standing on the other side of the world with a team of athletes supporting them to be able to compete at their best. If you look at any young athlete going to Youth World Championships or an open athlete that's grown up through all of that and is now like competing in open world championships, when we go, that athlete has been supported almost always via a bunch of volunteers in their gym, like volunteers or people not exactly getting paid a lot to run youth programs and do coaching and all that sort of stuff. They grow up through those programs. They compete at events that are completely run by volunteers.
Mm.
And then they go, they go through this process of winning local comps, winning their state comps, or placing their state comps, going to national events, winning a spot on the team, and then going overseas to compete. When they go overseas, they're supported. We look at Moscow last year. We had myself, we had Will, we had Kim, we had Sophie, we had Justine, we had five support staff. Those people are all going over there to support those athletes.
Taking time off work.
Taking unpaid leave from work. We have a limited budget, so their travel and accommodation is covered, but they're taking time off work, unpaid, to go and support. The same as when people are running those events domestically. They're taking time off work to go and route set, to go and, you know, officiate, to just run events. It takes a lot of people have to sacrifice a lot of time and a lot of money to make everything we do happen. And by the time you get through a big event, like with the Youth World Championships in 2008, by the time you come out at the end of something like that, you've got an entire group of people just exhausted and, you know, everyone's got their pockets turned out. Like, you know, it's cost everyone emotionally, physically, and financially for any of this stuff to happen.
So what are the, I think just to, you know, let people, because a lot of people don't know much about comps at all. Sure. So, I mean, we religiously watch the World Cups because we're obsessed, but with all things climbing. But so what do the coaches do on the ground? So you guys have to get a team of kids and open competitors across to the other side of the world safely and without their parents often, or mostly
without
their youth, parents.
They have to go with their parents. Other teams do it differently, but we...
Because I think Tom went to Ecuador as a youth 15-year-old without his parents.
Yeah. Nowadays we do...
And no stories shall be spread of that trip because my parents listen to this.
Yeah. Once we finish recording, you can tell us the stories. So we take parents or chaperones for ours now. But
So on the ground, because I don't think many people know about the stuff like, you know, what's happening in isolation, who's allowed in isolation, the protocols around that, getting people, athletes from hotels to
comps. Does it work?
Yeah, how does it work?
Yeah.
And, you know, the
complaints
procedure. Like,
I mean, what, I guess what are we doing? Head coach.
What are we doing? What's
your
job?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have, like I said before, we have myself as the coaching director, we have the three discipline coaches, we have an assistant coach and a physio. If we look at Moscow last year as an example, the Youth World Championships, we ran a training camp for the athletes in Europe prior to going to Moscow, so that all the kids got over there, they trained a bunch and got used to, like, they they get over the jet lag and all that sort of stuff and then pop over to Moscow, arrive at the event. We have, previous to this, obviously, we've arranged all of the accommodation and all of that stuff so everyone's in the same place. They're all together. At the event, you have a schedule of events. Obviously, there's all these different qualifying rounds. You've got Youth B, Youth A, Junior, male and female. You've got lead speed, boulder. You've got all these qualifications going on, and then semis, then finals, and there's just a million things going on. And we make sure we're across exactly what athletes are competing in what, at what time, and make sure they're aware we're all going to meet in the foyer at this time. We're going to walk you all down to the venue, and we're all going to do X, Y, and Z. So everyone knows where they've got to be and when they've got to be there. Then we have Justine, our physio, who is doing in-house treatments with athletes day in, day out, making sure they're in one piece. She's in the hotel doing treatments. She's at the venue doing treatments. We're traveling like miles down the road with a physio table, putting it in taxis and stuff and trying to cart it all over the countryside. Then we all get to the event and everyone's in the venue. We set Justine somewhere up so she can be working on athletes in the actual venue, work with them, going through warm-ups, working on niggles, all that sort of stuff. Then we have athletes have to go into isolation. So not everyone will be aware, but when you go into qualify or semifinals or any other part of the event, you get taken into a cordoned off section where you can't see the rest of the gym. We'll be all cordoned off and you are isolated, so you can't see the routes. It's on-site lead or whatever it is you're doing. You're in isolation. And we take all the athletes in there. Everyone gets their phones taken off them, all that sort of jazz. Yeah. And once you're in, that's it.
Yeah, you can't leave.
You can't leave. And if, as a coach, we can go in with that athlete, with that group of athletes, but once, if we leave, we can't go back in either.
Yeah.
So someone has to sit in isolation all day.
We're
quite lucky. We have Will, who is the king of isolation. He's fantastic at it. He's always got his bag of tricks and goes in with a bunch of athletes and keeps everyone very entertained and keeps everyone in in good mind frame and helps everyone warm up thoroughly.
We want him at nationals next time.
Yeah, so there you go, Will. Nationals isolation. Yeah. Everyone wants you in there. And so we'll have a coach or two sometimes go into isolation. They're there for the long haul. From there, we also have, outside of that, we have a couple other people doing a few other roles. So when that athlete goes out to, say we're talking about lead, they come out from isolation and they go out to climb their route. When they finish, like you said before, you go out, there's someone with a bucket, you're tied into a rope and you climb.
And you have to tie in a different way to what you tie in normally.
And then all of a sudden you climb this route and then you're like, where do I go now? And you get ushered out and you're like, what do I do? So we have a coach waiting at that gate to be able to grab you as you come out from that cordoned off competition zone and help you debrief, take you to where your gear is, make sure you're okay, go over what's just happened and help you to be able to leave the competition zone without getting too flustered, especially the kids. They're walking out and it's been this crazy experience and then they just walk into a crowd of thousands of people and you're like, great, come here, take you over to the rest of the team, your parents are this way, and just help them to decompress after such a sometimes
it's very full on
sort of experience. Then we have another coach who will be filming everything. So they'll be sitting in a coach's area or some other vantage point with an iPad or
Instagram. No, I'm joking.
It's not just for Instagram. Of us for the gram. Come on. Some of us for the gram. But they'll be filming every attempt. So we'll have athletes and we'll have coaches and sometimes parents, if we know there's going to be too many athletes of ours on the wall at the one time, filming entire runs or an entire route or entire boulders. Because if there's something that needs to be appealed for whatever reason, you have to have you know, evidence of the reason why you're
and
appealing.
And it can be the difference between making semis or not.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, and that's, yeah. You know, that's an important thing. So we've got, so at that point, we've got a physio somewhere in the facility tucked into a quiet corner. We've got someone in isolation. We've got someone at the gate waiting to help them as the athletes come off stage. We have someone filming everything. And then we have someone running around trying to like coordinate.
Making sure the next
everyone.
Person's in the right place.
Yeah, you're in the right place. And just like taking athletes from A to B and helping with queries and, you know, I can't find my tape and where's my mum and, you know, whatever. You know, all that stuff.
A lot more to it than just getting on a plane and having a holiday.
No, there's so much more to it.
And also it's observing what the other teams are doing, what the level's like.
Yeah.
What the warm-up protocols are like for other teams.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we're there, especially when you look at something like Youth World Championships, like there's so much going on and there's a bunch of young athletes that need plenty of assistance. There's the actual day-to-day management of a team at an event, but then there's the rest of it. Like you said, there's trying to understand like where are our athletes compared to athletes in other teams? What are the differences? What are they doing that we're not? What can we learn from that? What can we learn from the way our athletes performed compared to the way that, you know, athlete X performed? And being able to take that home and inform those athletes better as to what they're missing, what they need to work on, and help them to improve what they're doing back at home so they can go back next time better prepared.
Yeah, that's I guess in some way ties back to that having that national facility. Like, do you see us having like a kind of coaching protocol or like standard or guidelines or something there that it's like this is the standard of knowledge that a coach needs to have?
Is that what they have in other countries? Like, do they have, does Japan have their coaching protocol?
Yeah, so we, at the moment, Australia doesn't have coaching qualifications specific to rock climbing.
Mm.
And there's, that's actually in the works right now. There's a committee that's working on developing what our coaching qualification system will look like, as well as the education system that's going to go into place to be able to certify people. And that happens in every other sport. Every other sport has that stuff. My qualifications from gymnastics and swimming years ago, you know, went through a certain process, and it's probably changed about four times since then. But it's something that's not in place here that is in place in other countries for sport climbing. So it's something that's still still being
developed. So we're looking at having a national climbing facility when we work out how the heck to raise the money for
when
that.
When we find X millions of dollars.
National accreditation.
National accreditation
and so
for coaches, yes.
To wrap up the Olympics kind of part of the podcast, so what we talked a bit about fundraising and that grant writing stuff before, what are the other, say, three or four key things that you'd ideally love to have or that we need to get Australian climbing up there?
Oh.
To get us the money to behind the sport.
Well, I mean, the main thing is like the thing that solves all of our problems is finances, and whether that's going to come from government bodies, private investors, wherever that comes from, it's the crux of the entire issue.
Mm.
And with money, we can do all the things that we need to do. We can develop those coaching standards, those qualifications, because that process in itself costs a fortune. Just to get that education system up and running will cost a lot of money, and we need a national training facility. We need the funds to be able to
get athletes to events
and we need the funds to be able to pay the support staff that are going to be coaching them, and the physiotherapists and the sports psychologists and all that sort of stuff.
I mean,
like
for my dietitian things that I've run. I mean, I've run things for the junior team and for the open, well, for the whole Australian team. And and Lee Cossie and Justine also did that.
Doing fantastic work.
And it was for free.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we love climbing and we think it's important for the sport. But Yeah.
And eventually we all want to see that we have structures in place that allow those athletes to develop into the best athletes they can be. Mm. And all of the different things that we need, all the ingredients that make that like awesome sport climbing pie, cost money.
Yeah.
And it really is the crux of our situation, for sure.
So we're looking for people to come up with some ideas and people with expertise to step up that can help.
Absolutely. Like we've said a dozen times so far, like this whole sport is run by volunteers, and that's not going to change anytime really soon. What Sport Climbing Australia probably could use more than anything else right now would be someone with solid grant writing and fundraising experience to come to the front and put their hand up and be like, I can help. Someone that's, I mean, even if that was two people, someone with like fantastic, you know, grant writing skills and someone that's got a lot of experience in general fundraising. How do you run like national fundraising programs? How can you, you know, leverage different events and all the rest to raise that money through whatever means? I'm not an expert in fundraising. I did one little fundraising event and, yeah, managed to get a couple of bucks together. Like, I'm not an expert on the topic. So we need someone who is.
Yeah.
Well, someone who really knows how to get their hands on money for sporting, sporting associations is who we need. So if there's someone listening right now, drop us a line and just put your hand up because, like,
we
would love you on board.
Yeah. And no smartass is saying that you can sell 7,500 boxes of Cadbury chocolates.
Although I don't think that's
That would necessitate a dietitian.
Chocolate. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it really is a case of like every penny counts.
Yeah.
Like, I did a little fundraising thing a little while ago at our gym where I climbed. It was ridiculous. Should have
your hands
done something
looked
else.
Horrendous afterwards.
I climbed like the equivalent of the height of Everest, and it was heinous. But yeah, we raised like a couple of grand, and in the scheme of things in sport, like a couple of grand is nothing.
Yeah,
but to us that was a lot
compared with Formula One races.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a tank of fuel around Bahrain.
It's a tank of fuel in Bahrain. Exactly, and it really makes a difference, and that puts a bit of perspective perhaps on like where we are in this country, where like a couple of grand makes a huge difference.
That's you being able to be there full time in Japan in August to help support
or it's
12 athletes going
over. Two or three more training camps domestically where we can help athletes like yourself learn more about speed climbing.
Yeah, right? Which like, I know nothing about.
That's the difference. Like that $2,000 can go a long way to helping a lot of athletes. And that's where we are. I've talked to people in other sports all the time and they just seem flabbergasted at how we manage to do anything. Cause they're just like, you have how much money? That's not much. You just ask for more.
Somebody out there investing. Clients.
So yeah, long story short, like if there's someone out there that can do, you know, grant writing and fundraising, like put your hand up,
help us
make yourself
out how
known.
To get that climbing facility built.
Yeah.
It'd be amazing. But it just does feel like the thing. It's like if we had a facility and that physical structure there, it kind of feels like everything else could almost somewhat fall into place. Like
absolutely.
You've got...
Because you'd have somewhere then to be able to say, all right, we can do... route setter courses, we can do route setting professional development, so we can help all of the route setters in this country to learn to set to that standard, which they then take home to their local gyms and they become better route setters at home, and then we have a gym that's full of these amazing high level routes of, you know, superb quality and the right sort of intensities and all that sort of stuff that we can then bring the athletes to and train on, and we can do this year in, year out,
it
leading
also,
people
it
into
a culture. It joins the competitive climbing culture together a bit more.
And I feel like, you know, we've got some amazing people in this country, both in you guys as coaches and the people kind of organizing stuff, and we've got amazing athletes, and we've got
amazing
gym owners and route setters
or gym managers.
Yeah. But it's kind of like, you know, to go to the Formula One thing, it's like you've got the drivers and all the pit crew and everything.
Which don't have a car.
And you've got like, you know, something that Dad knocked up the night before of the billy cart derby and it's the lawnmower wheels and we're just like, we've got need an engine.
Yep.
Please.
So that we don't feel like the Jamaican bobsled team.
Yeah. Yeah. And
although John Candy could come back and like, I don't know, play some sort of comical role in the remaking of the Australian climbing team movie.
He can be team manager.
Yeah.
John Candy, team manager. Look, you're absolutely right. It is that missing element, and we have the athletes. We have some amazingly talented athletes in this country.
We do.
That rarely, I feel, rarely get the opportunity to truly reach their potential.
Absolutely.
And you know, there's the ingredients are all there. We have the athletes. We have the coaches. We have the support staff. We have like the motivation. We have the drive. We have all of these things. We just need somewhere.
We need someone to build it.
So we need someone to build it.
So we can go to
build it and we will come.
Build it and we will come. Yeah. And it just comes down to finances. It really does. So
let's hope we can make the big dream come true.
Fingers crossed.
Yep.
Thanks for listening in, guys. As Duncan says in there, if there is anyone out there with grant proposal writing experience that wants to donate a bit of their time to helping out Sport Climbing Australia, that would be a huge help. Either contact Sport Climbing Australia directly or get in contact with us, Baffle Days, and we can put you in contact with the right people. Follow us on Instagram to keep up to date with everything that's going on. Hit subscribe on your podcast app. Tell your mates. Get the word out there. Baffle Days is awesome. And we'll catch you on the next one.